You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Welcome to Brookings. My name is Ron Haskins. I'm the co-director, along with Richard Reeves, of the Center on Children and Families here at Brookings. Today we're releasing the 29th volume of The Future of Children. When I read that and we added these up, I almost died of exhaustion. It takes a lot to put these volumes out, and we've been doing it, I think, 10 or 11 years. And this is our 27th policy brief, so we produced a lot of work. In this volume and policy brief, we address the vital issues of how to achieve broad-scale impacts with our social programs. We focus for several years on evidence-based policy, on developing programs that high-quality evaluations show are capable of producing impacts on important child and family outcomes. But the goal of universal programs we are promoting today is to ensure that high-quality programs can have a broad range of impacts. We want to help as many communities as possible build up their capacity to help families provide effective services for their children, especially the families and children at highest risk. As we argue in the policy brief, which is available outside at the table, including the infrastructure to support programs with universal reach requires three steps. First, create a mechanism that allows all families in a community to be assessed. Second, develop ways to identify and recommend professionals in the local community who can provide needed services on a timely basis. And third, identify programs that are capable of developing sophisticated ways to track families, the services they receive, and the outcomes of these services. All of these steps are reviewed in the volume and examples are provided. And all the presentations this morning will discuss one or more of these steps and how they're accomplished in various programs around the country. Generally, our approach in the volume and in the individual chapters is to change the point at which public concern about families comes into play. We want to move away from a singular emphasis on fixing flawed parents and toward enhancing the context in which parents raise their children, to shift the focus from stopping or preventing negative parenting to promoting the positive, about measuring success in terms of changes not just among individual participants in the programs, but also among population-level indicators, about creating a framework in which universal strategies contribute to a more equitable and efficient allocation of resources. Above all, it's about reconsidering the balance among competing goals: child safety, enhanced child development, and parental autonomy. We leave it to our readers to examine the eight chapters in this volume to learn more about the specific means by which parenting programs are helping children at the community level in eight of the communities with the most sophisticated programs. During our event this morning, you will hear from one of the biggest programs in the nation, the Texas Home Visiting Program, and its chief evaluator, Cynthia Osborne, of the University of Texas. Based on her experience in running this large evaluation, Dr. Osborne has several interesting observations about both the programs themselves at the local level and about their evaluations. As you will hear, her conclusions raise serious issues that bear on the success of these programs. Dr. Osborne is the Associate Dean of Academic Strategies at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. Her teaching and research focus on poverty and inequality, family and child well-being, and family demography. Cynthia.
Good morning, and thank you, Ron, for the opportunity to attend this important event and to share some of my thoughts on universal programs to support new parents. I'm a big fan of this universal approach, and I'm going to tell you why. As Ron said, for the past 8 years, I've had the privilege of evaluating the Texas Home Visiting Program. This is a program funded both by McVie dollars as well as general revenue dollars. And over this time period, we've spoken with and surveyed mothers and fathers and home visitors and supervisors to understand everything we can about how to implement a home visiting program, why folks participate in these home visiting programs, and what they gain from their participation. And it's clear from the hundreds of folks that we've spoken with and the thousands of folks that we've surveyed that the parents truly value their home visiting program. They appreciate learning new skills and being connected to resources, but far and away, the thing that they value most is their relationship with their home visitor. Some folks call their home visitors a nurse, others call them a teacher, some just call them their person. But for all, it's their relationship with their home visitor that helps to reduce their social isolation, and it makes them feel connected and like they have a trusted person who makes them feel important in their children's lives. But in addition to these interviews and surveys, we've also analyzed the program model's administrative data, and we've supplemented it with collecting parenting and children's socioemotional outcome measures. We've linked it with child welfare data and with school readiness data. And the findings from these analyses are largely consistent with many of the other rigorous empirical studies on home visiting programs. That is, in the aggregate, the results show modest to minimal impacts on family well-being. And what I mean is that when we look at the impact of home visiting programs on our full sample of folks who have received our home visiting services, we see only very small positive increases in a few outcomes. This is what they found in MyHope and in the MyHope study, and it's what nearly every study listed on the HomeVie website shows. But I want to be clear, this does not mean that home visiting doesn't work. We have to be very careful about how we interpret these modest findings. You see, home visiting does help the families who need the help the most. When we disaggregate our data by the number of risk factors present at program enrollment, such as whether they're a teen parent, have very low income, are victims of domestic violence, we see that the more risk factors that a person has at enrollment, the greater gains in parenting we see from program participation. But the large number of mothers who enter our programs with relatively minimal risks do not have much room for improvement on many of the outcomes that we measure. And when we lump all of the families together in our analyses, we see that the overall effects are small. But this is often masking the effects that the programs have on those who need the help the most. So, if we see that programs really only work well for a subset of families with high needs, then why would I be a fan of universal approaches or universal programs? If everyone's getting the program, then won't the effects be even smaller still? Well, the reason is that universal programs allow us to identify the families who need the most help. And then we can provide those families with the type of program or services that best meet their needs. Texas is one of the largest McVie-funded home visiting programs in the U.S., but still, after nearly 8 years, we've served fewer than 15,000 families across three program models in 35 communities. There are 400,000 babies born in Texas every year. So of the 2 million or so kids under age 5 at any point in time in Texas, we've served only a tiny fraction. If we somehow knew that this small bet were the ones who really needed our services the most, then that may not be so concerning. But that's not really the case. The state did target its home visiting services into communities with the highest needs, meaning that they have high levels of poverty or high rates of teen pregnancy, for instance. But when we look at the families who are enrolled in our programs across these communities, their level of need varies quite considerably. We also see that communities have very different strategies of how they recruit families into their programs. Some have pretty systematic approaches in which they link with doctor's offices or with schools, and they're referring the families that they identify who might need help. Whereas others, and I kid you not, were recruiting out of Walmart parking lots, that anyone who looked like a 3-year-old must need their program. They're not doing that anymore, CQI and all that. So we've addressed that. But all programs struggle to keep their slots full. meaning that we struggled to identify and serve the families who could benefit the most. And when we find these families with needs, we often give them the services that we have versus necessarily giving them and connecting them with the services that they need. And these challenges are going to persist if we continue to think of home visiting programs as the solution in and of themselves. Home visiting programs are a mechanism for helping families. The programs vary considerably in their approach and in their success at addressing various outcomes, and they vary in their impacts and how they differ for different people. And we have to move toward a system of care that provides the right program for the right problem for the right people. And universal approaches can really help move us in this direction. A program such as Family Connects, which is spotlighted both in the brief and in the journal and that Ken will speak with later today, this program meets every new family shortly after the birth to identify the issues that the family might be struggling with. For some, it might be that they need more resources and the nurse can help connect them with WIC. For others, they may need help with breastfeeding. Others might have high blood pressure and they need to return to their OB prior to their 6-week visit. This is something that is pretty common that we're seeing in Austin. Others might have very few social connections and they may need a lot of help with their parenting. But by knowing a family's unique set of needs, we can then get the right resources to the right people. And this approach is going to help us to fill our home visiting programs with the folks who need the services that the home visiting programs provide, and we'll likely see the individual program models' overall impacts improve. Another important feature of the universal approach is that it provides the community with a complete understanding of the needs of its families. Although it's not simple to just change things overnight, communities can begin to change the basket of services that they provide to better align with what the communities actually need. Too frequently, we offer what we have because we don't fully understand what our families need. But universal approaches are not magic and they're not simple. They have their challenges as well. I've been involved in trying to launch the Family Connects model in Austin, Texas. And we are moving along and making great progress, but we're still facing challenges just like all other communities will face. First, the universal approach is only as strong as that basket of services that a community actually has to offer. Austin's fortunate in this regard. We may have too much of one thing and not enough of another, but we're resource rich and we can align our services over time. But by contrast, our friends to the east are launching Family Connects in a rural area of the state. Their community has been made stronger by coming together to implement the program, but they have also identified the many gaps in services that they have. For starters, they didn't have a birthing hospital. Another challenge is that we might still not fully understand all the needs of our families. Universal approaches typically work as screeners to more targeted services, but building trust so that the family is honest about their struggles, it often takes time. So we're going to miss some folks, and their needs are going to change over time. So we need to make sure that we have backup plans in place. We also need to think about when universal screening or supports needs to begin. Family Connects, for example, begins at birth, and I've said this to Ken before, and in my opinion, this is 9 months too late, and it might even be a couple of years too late if we really want to address the effects of adversity on parents and babies. And so we need to be sure that we're constantly seeking opportunities to support young adults who will likely become parents. I also encourage all the programs to focus on the whole family and not just mother and child. Family Connects focus on whoever lives in the household, and this is a great start. But the father who doesn't live in the household will have a huge influence on both the mother and the child's development. And so I would hope that our programs would take this into consideration as well. And like with any program, taking something to scale is a challenge. Bigger is better, as we say in Texas, but it's also harder. In Austin, we struggled a bit getting integrated into the hospital system so that we can gain consent to offer the programs to moms. And the more that any approach is seen as something that is separate from rather than integrated into our healthcare and social services delivery system, we'll continue to struggle with that approach. Lactation consultants, birth registrars, they don't need permission to see moms, but the nurses do. And this may evolve over time, but it's currently a struggle. Also, finding and maintaining qualified staff is a problem for all home visiting models, but it's even more of a challenge for universal programs. And this is a problem in Austin, so you can only imagine how hard it is for smaller and more rural communities. Finally, balancing a universal program with the unique characteristics and experiences of all families is a challenge that we must be committed to addressing. The programs need to be culturally sensitive and consider issues of language and cultural norms, and they need to take into consideration the biases that some of the providers may have. All of these challenges can be overcome, but it is important that we take them seriously as we roll out new approaches. In closing, I want to affirm my support for home visiting programs in general, but even more so for universal approaches that allow us to identify the unique needs of families and tailor what we provide to effectively meet those needs. Universal approaches will allow us to serve more families overall, and it will preserve our targeted intervention programs for those who will benefit most. Integrating screens and referrals into our healthcare and social service delivery system will lead to improvements in overall population health, and it's going to help us ensure that our kids get off to a healthy start. I'm going to stop there and have a discussion with Ron.
Thank you for that. That was very good. For the audience, we are going to hear today from three of the biggest and best-known programs in the country, not just the Texas program, which I think is the largest evaluation and attempt to set up a program throughout a state. As you said, everything in Texas is big.
It's all big.
Yeah, I never heard that before. So Texas, and then the First Five L.A., which is a remarkable program in L.A., which is like the rest of the country put together, has more diversity, and it's an amazing place. And they have made a lot of progress, and they've spent a lot of time trying to organize the county so they can support these programs and get the money and so forth to do it. So we'll hear about that, and you can read more about it in the issue of Future Children that we gave you. And then we'll hear about Family Connects, which Cynthia referred to, a program Ken more or less invented, and it's now in 16 communities in the United States and other places in the world, and I think it's the most impressive of the programs that they have tried to be implemented in a series of places. So the point of all this is that we are trying to lay the groundwork for how you can create these programs and spread them around the country, because we're serious about universal. We want to have home visiting, universally available, high quality, in every community, and helping every family that needs it. And so this, we're already off to a good start. I think it's an amazing, over the last, what, 6-8 years, how much progress we've made and how many communities have a program. There is one big problem, though, that you put your finger on, and I assume all three of us will get a chance to discuss that, and that is I see Ginger. Didn't I see Ginger back there? So, Ginger, will you stick your fingers in your ears, please? The programs have not produced highly impressive results. And this is both on the national evaluation that Ginger was in charge of and an individual home program. And many, I'm going to say, led to believe, but they believed that because of David Olds, and the Family Nurse Partnership, we could expect some really big impacts that would last for many years. And for a big program, universal in coverage, it seems that we're not going to get that kind of thing. Do you think that's a problem, and what should we do about it?
I think that with universal approach, we actually might see better impacts, because although the impacts and aggregate have been pretty modest, that when you even look at each of the individual program models and you look to see where they've made the biggest impacts, it's for the families that were the most disadvantaged when they entered the program. And if we can get the most vulnerable families into the programs that are that intensive, then we may be able, and we can keep them in the program, right? Retention is a whole other issue. Then we might be able to actually see bigger impacts from the individual programs. And everyone else has some sort of need. Every new parent, anyone who's been a new parent, has some sort of need. But they may not need 2 years of a program, or they may not need 5 years of a program. They may not need a program at all. They may need some sort of connection to a resource or something else. So I think that what we're doing in many of these evaluations is that what we haven't done is the program models have not done a great job of saying, this program works best for these families under these circumstances, and here's why. Instead, at least in my experience, we've pretty well assumed that every program model will work for every family for any problem that they have, instead of really aligning what we know the program is intended to do with the right families who will benefit the most. So I'm hopeful that a universal approach will allow us to screen better and make it so that folks are not just getting anyone that they can in their program to fill their slots, but actually saying, this family needs this service. And then I think that we're going to see bigger impacts.
You mentioned something I think is definitely going to be one of the big issues of any universal program. We've already seen it in almost every model program that we've tried. I studied the Bush Marriage Initiative pretty carefully. Read evaluations carefully. And there was tremendous attrition.
Yeah.
So the families it appears that the families we most want to reach are the families that are hardest to keep in the program.
Yeah.
And I remember, for example, in Little Rock, I think that the percentage of families that enrolled in the program who got even 20% or something like that was, I think, 10% of the families. So how can you have an effective intervention, especially if you're trying to have universal reach,
right,
and affect a whole community? So what's your recommendation about that? You've tried to do a program for thousands and thousands of people.
Yeah, we have the same levels of attrition that everyone else has, and if not more. What we were trying to do is to see how much of the program you need in order to start to see some benefits from the program, and what sort of outcomes. So we were doing kind of repeated measures of our outcomes and kind of every 4 months or so to see if they have that much of the program, did they start to see some changes and so forth. We actually saw that the benefits of the program accrued early and were sustained regardless of kind of how long you stayed in the program. But I think that we need to answer the question better of how much do you need in order to get the benefits of the program. And to also, you know, of course, I'm speaking more as an evaluator than as an implementer, but the folks who are evaluating, they need to be a little bit more clear about attrition. That's something that's really hard to dig into when you read how large the level of attrition was in some of our studies. So we don't know if the program effects that we're actually seeing in the peer-reviewed articles, how they dealt with attrition, and whether those effects include all of the attrition, and that's maybe why some of the effects are smaller. Anyway, I think that this is an area that we have to suss out, but I would like for the program models to tell us more about how much do you need to start to see some sort of benefits in certain ways, and we haven't done that.
Here's another thing we're going to have to talk about, and we'll talk to the other two presenters as well, and that is financing. You mentioned that your program dealt with a tiny fraction of the people who you would have liked to have seen in the program, and yet you had one of the biggest programs that existed. And the federal government does not seem to be overly committed to spending more money on these programs. Some of the states are, but a lot aren't. Mm-hmm. Many of the parents, most of the parents, are not well-to-do by any means. So what? How are we going to finance these programs?
I think that's a really important question. I don't want anyone to take the number that we've spent and divide it by the number that we've served and look at the cost per family, because one would beg the question of why not just give that money to the families at this point. It's pretty high. But there are mechanisms for doing this. States that have expanded Medicaid are able to use Medicaid dollars to pay for some of the prevention services. Hospital systems are starting to say this is a service that our folks need and this will benefit us in the long run. So our, I would say, maybe more insurance carriers, the hospitals make money off of sick people, insurance make money off keeping people well. So that's a potential, but it's a challenge. You know, we're in Austin trying to piecemeal public and private and foundation dollars to make this happen. And although the cost per person is relatively low, you know, we have 17,000 babies born in Austin. In Parkland Hospital in Dallas is 25,000 babies born in that hospital itself, right? So even if it's only $500 a kid, that's a lot of money. So I don't have the solution, but I think that we're going to have to also learn from the studies what the return on the investment is. Some of the universal approaches are demonstrating that the money that we save in terms of hospitalizations or child welfare, after 6 months, 2 years, is actually paying for itself. So we can figure this out, but we do have to just be committed to it, and we have to say this is the right approach and figure out the different funding mechanisms to make it happen.
Okay, one more question. A crucial part of these programs, as is always the case with social programs, is the parents. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the parents in your program. Did they like the program? Were they happy? What was their greatest objection? Were there places in the state that the program had trouble getting off the ground because the parents just were not enthusiastic? Tell us about how the parents felt.
Yeah, and it varies a lot. First of all, the ones that I talked with are probably the ones who are more sanguine about the program than those who don't talk to us.
Program directors made sure of that, right?
Well, we didn't recruit through the program directors for that reason, but still, they left the program if they didn't like it. But on average, I mean, we talked to dads and we talked to moms, and they really do like these programs. So that is, I would say, on average. But there are some concerns. So we know that especially in Texas, we have East Texas, which is a lot like the Deep South. And in there, the idea of having someone kind of come into your house is a pretty big step. You know, I was raised as a Southerner, and, you know, you have to make sure your laundry's put away, and, you know, having company over is a big deal. And
what, you didn't like to put your laundry away?
My laundry's always put away, Ron. but to allow people into your house, especially if your house has a hole in the middle of it, if the floor or is dilapidated, we had a lot of folks who were resisting, not to mention that the home visitor would have to drive 40 or 50 miles in order to get to their home. So we had a lot of struggles in East Texas to the point that one community actually had to shut down its program because it couldn't recruit enough families, and we started in another place. We have other communities that are not necessarily resistant to having someone come into their house, but in our border regions, they're somewhat resistant to just participating in programs in general, and that's been worse in the last several years because of our immigration issues. But by and large, it is the trust that the nurse or the home visitor creates with the family that allows them into their house. And as the communities have been more established, the programs have been longer established in the communities,
then they are, this is word of mouth. Oh, you know, my friend did this, or my sister did this, my cousin. And that, we found, is the best way for folks to gain trust about the program is through just that word of mouth. So when it becomes part of a universal system of care, then I think that we're going to be able to build greater trust and get greater access to our families. When it's still seen as something that's separate and people haven't necessarily heard about it, it makes it more difficult.
So there'll be something like a transition period.
When
in some communities it would be difficult to get parents to want to be in the program and maybe even resist, but that won't last very long. Once people start joining and the word gets around, people really like it.
That's my hope. I think so.
Okay, good. Yep. All right, well, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
You can't leave yet.
I won't.
Okay.
I will sit down and watch the other program.
Ask you some more questions.
Okay.
And like to ask Deb and Ken to come
I
on.
Almost did.
Oh, don't tell them I did that.
I was warned not to do that.
Yeah, I know it. I was too, about 80 times so far. All right, we turn now to Kenneth Dodge and Deborah Darrow to hear about two additional home visiting programs. Dr. Dodge and his co-author W. Benjamin Goodman present a summary of his program, Family Connects. Remember that name, Family Connects, a very well-known program, one of the best known of the home visiting programs. The basic idea of Family Connects is straightforward and is a major component of all family programs that aim to extend their reach to entire communities, namely that almost every community has a menu of programs and services and that with effective identification and planning, these programs and services can provide needed help to families, especially if they're knit together. One of the most important innovations of the community-based programs described in the volume is their progress in figuring out how to identify effective services already available in the community and how to connect families that need the services to the best programs. A remarkable feature of Dr. Dodge's program is that high-quality studies have shown that these community-based programs have significant impacts. Another remarkable feature of his program is that it is now being conducted in 16 communities in the U.S. and in international sites, making it one of the most widely used programs in the world. Dr. Dodge is a Pritzker Professor of Public Policy and Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at Duke University. Don't let him try to tell you he's at UNC. He's also a founding and past director of the Center for Child and Family Policy at Duke. Ken.
Thank you, Ron. Good morning. Thank you all for being here. I want to start by thanking and acknowledging Ron and Deb for your vision and wisdom in putting together the conference and volume that undergirds this policy brief and engineering today's event. Thank you for letting me come along for the ride. And thank you, Cynthia, for traveling here and your comments as well. I want to talk with you about Family Connects. And want you to think about the concept of primary psychosocial care. So you can think about pediatric health care, primary care. You don't have to be sick to go to a pediatrician. A pediatrician assesses your child, helps with some tips, you know, sleep on your back and wear a car seat and get great nutrition and all of that. But the pediatrician also refers you to the otolaryngologist and the radiologist and the physical therapist, et cetera. Think about that in a psychosocial way, and I think you get the main idea. All right, so the premise behind Family Connects is that communities do have a menu of programs and services. Community might have nurse family partnership that serves 50 children. It might have a healthy families program, early Head Start, some substance abuse treatment program for mothers, WIC, SNAP food stamps, child care, has an array of services. But families are on their own to navigate those services. There's no one there to connect families to those services. If you are the parent, have been the parent of a young child, you get it. You know that. So what happens? Some families do very well. They know how to navigate those services. They might even get too many of them. Other families get too few of them. They fall through the cracks, or they get the wrong ones. As you can imagine, that's where disparities in services, group disparities in services, and children's outcomes begin to grow because the advantaged, in-the-know, well-connected families, middle-class families, they can find the right services, and the disenfranchised, disadvantaged, low-income, discriminated against families in our communities are the ones who don't know how to work the system. And the disparities by groups begin to grow that way. So with those premises, Family Connects, we developed beginning about 20 years ago through generous support from the Duke Endowment. The idea is that we aim to improve population outcome for children by figuring out systematically how to reach every birth in a community, number one. Number two, when we reach them, to connect with them, and to understand their individual family needs. One family might need a substance abuse intervention program for a mother who is affected by an opioid addiction. Another family might need child care. Another family might need to get enrolled in Medicaid. Right? They vary. To assess those individual needs. And then third, to catalyze the community resources to meet family-specific needs. This is not a long-term intervention program. This is really primary care. Costs about $600 a family. In a nutshell, the model is depicted on this slide. First, the nurse connects with the family. We typically try to engage families in the birthing hospital 1 hour after giving birth. In Durham, North Carolina, at Duke Regional Hospital, for example, the OBGYN delivering doctor prescribes Family Connects and says a nurse is going to come to your room. And she does, and she engages the family and schedules a home visit for about 3 weeks of age and goes from there. So the nurse connects with the family, systematically identifies the needs. Then the nurse connects the family to individually tailored, designed community resources that that family might need. They might need to get enrolled in Medicaid. They might need a substance abuse intervention program. They might need a parent support group or help with breastfeeding or what to do when your baby's sleeping at 2 or crying at 2 a.m. and you just can't sleep. So that, third, the parent can connect with the infant. This is not a replacement for families or parenting. This is to catalyze and support families so parents can parent their infant. There are three core program components. The first, at the top, is this community alignment of community resources. Map them, figure out what's available in a community, where there are gaps, that sort of thing. In Durham, North Carolina, for example, we now have an electronic directory of 425 community agencies that serve parents at birth, all of those that I've described to you, and they're annotated. The second part is this home visiting. We have a trained nurse who greets the family in the hospital and then comes to the home at about 3 weeks of age to engage in this home visit. She has at her disposal this electronic directory of community resources so she can do the matching. Right? And the third part is the data and monitoring system, including this electronic record that gets developed of the child, of the infant and the family's needs, as well as an electronic record of the community resources. And then they're put together. All right, that's it in a nutshell. I will diverge for a moment and say that individual to this individual family level that we're talking about, the idea behind Family Connects is also a community intervention. Imagine being the mayor of Durham, North Carolina. Now you've got more than 80% of the birthing families in an electronic database, and you can identify that whatever percent of mothers say they are willing to, that they need and are willing to receive substance abuse intervention, right? You can map those needs from these aggregated case records. And then second, you can also map the community assets. Oh, this is a fact. In Durham, we found that 11% of birthing mothers told us they had a substance abuse problem that they were willing to receive intervention for. We went to the electronic directory and found out that community capacity to serve those mothers was only 2 to 3%. What a gap. That's probably not unlike many communities. We could go to the county commissioners, appeal to them with empirical data. They allocated more dollars for a substance abuse intervention program for mothers who wanted to stay at home. So with that, you can identify gaps and surpluses for planning and funding. Let me tell you a little bit about evaluation of Family Connects. We've tried to evaluate both the implementation and the impact of Family Connects as best we can. I'll tell you about the first randomized controlled trial that we did. We're engaged in more randomized controlled trials and field quasi-experiments as well. So first, we randomly assigned in Durham, North Carolina, consecutive births to intervention or control, consecutive births over an 18-month period, 4,777 of them. This is every birth, resident of Durham, delivering in Durham, in the community. There's no consent. Every birth on a register, on a birth record, is in the study. All right? And then we implemented Family Connects with those that have been randomly assigned to receive it. And we found some implementation findings. First of all, 80% in the trial agreed to participate. That is, they gave consent. They said, this sounds like a good idea. And of those, 86% of them went on to actually complete all aspects of the program, including the home visits, any referrals, that sort of thing. We were able to do it with pretty good fidelity, high reliability and quality. Fidelity to the protocol in the manual that we have, 86% of the items. We had independent raters come in and auditors and check fidelity. Kappa in scoring, that's chance-adjusted agreement in the way that the protocol is scored. That was pretty good. And we found from those case records that Family Connects improves connections. So 94% of the families in the Family Connects program identified a need at birth. It's an astoundingly high number, but if you've been a parent, you've given birth, you know how that rings true. It might be minor, you need support for breastfeeding or a parenting support group, or it might be more major, like substance abuse intervention or domestic violence intervention or intervention for postpartum depression or something like that. Of that 90%, among those, we found that a little over half of them, the nurse was able to resolve the minor problem. Oh, you need a child care facility because you're going back to work. I have an electronic directory. There are three highly rated five-star programs between your home and work. Let me connect you to them. And this one takes a child care subsidy that you qualify for, so let's go there. I've got an appointment for us on Tuesday at 2 o'clock. I'll bring you over there, and let's see if that's where you want to have your baby go when you go back to work, right? So the nurse can resolve a little over half of them. The other half, 45%, were referred to a community resource, one of these professional agencies. And of those, 79% were actually successfully connected. So we didn't just give them a phone number. You actually have to bring them there and connect them and follow up. That's pretty good. Let's get to the randomized controlled trial findings. So at age 6 months, now we came back with interviewers who were blinded to whether the family had been receiving Family Connects or not. And compared to control families, we found that Family Connects assigned families had indeed more connections to community services and resources. That's good. That meant lower maternal reported anxiety and depression. Mothers were more calm and confident. More mother reported positive parenting behaviors and higher quality mothering as rated by condition blinded observers, and higher quality and safer home environments. And then finally, among those who had placed their child in out of home child care, higher quality child care facilities. No effect on whether they went to out of home child care or not. This is not a program to push children into, infants into out-of-home child care. That's a family choice. All right. Now, let's get to the findings that have some dollar involvement and some ecological importance. We went to the administrative records of the hospitals in Durham and measured emergency room visits and overnights in the hospitals for the infants over a period of time. And what I've got graphed here is the cumulative mean episodes of emergency health care visits that cost a lot of money across the first 60 months of a child's life, first 5 years. The red line is the natural course for the control families. As you can see, it's a nice trajectory and curve of a lot of emergency care use initially in the first years of life, and then it smooths off by age 4 and 5. The blue line, let me call it the Carolina blue line, is the Family Connects mean, and you can see that it begins at a lower level, and the trajectory is one of lower, so that by age 5 years, there's been about one-third less emergency room visits, overnights in the hospital, and dollar costs as a result. All right. Next, we went to the Child Protective Services records from the state of North Carolina and charted the number of investigations for child maltreatment, abuse, and neglect for these infants. And again, I've got graphed the cumulative mean number of investigations across the first 60 months of life. The red line is the control mean. You can see it just keeps going up across the first 5 years of life. The blue line is the Family Connects mean, and it starts and ends up on a lower trajectory. Again, 37% fewer investigations for child maltreatment. Both of those lead to a lot of human savings and dollar savings as well. And so as a result, communities have been coming to us to see if we would be willing to help them implement the program. And so we're engaged in the dissemination. Although each time we engage in dissemination, we engage the community in the idea of whether we can learn more, because we don't know yet that what works in Durham is going to work in Bangor, Maine, or Santa Fe, New Mexico, or somewhere else. And so each new community is an opportunity for learning. I've got pictured here, the blue states are the ones that are implementing Family Connects now. The green ones are ones where we have a contract to plan and to begin to implement. And the yellow ones are where we're in the early stages. It's now up to about 40 communities across, I think, 18 states. And almost every week, we're building and we're growing. All right. Let me tell you a little bit about our innovations, because this is not the be-all and end-all. This is just the beginning of building a primary psychosocial system of care that would go from the prenatal period at least through the beginning of formal elementary school, when I would argue there's another system of care that does kick in, our public education system. All right, so we want to focus prenatal to age five. So at the prenatal period, we are now collaborating with the Nurse Family Partnership to try to bring these ideas to a prenatal universal system, reaching every woman who is pregnant comes to prenatal care universally to engage with her, screen for her needs at that time, her family's needs at that time, do some brief psychosocial interventions, or connect her with community resources. And we're working with Nurse Family Partnership for it. We're not replacing Nurse Family Partnership or competing, actually collaborating and catalyzing them, because if we can reach universally every woman who's pregnant in the community, we can figure out which ones we can refer to the Nurse Family Partnership, which I would call the neurosurgery of psychosocial care, right, that you want to reserve for that precious few that really need it and would benefit from it. Postnatal innovations, we are working collaboratively with the Healthy Steps program. If you know the Healthy Steps program, it is a child development specialist placed into pediatric care. And so we're working on transitioning families from Family Connects, which is short-term, time-limited, cheap, transitioning the families into pediatric care so they could continue what they've started. And we're working with Healthy Steps to design essentially an age 12-month, 24-month, and 36-month versions of Family Connects, of universally reaching out, reaching every family, screening, identifying needs, attending to short-term minor needs, and referring to community resources for more major needs. Third thing we're doing is working on the child's cumulative experience. So I'm really jazzed up about this idea of a child's psychosocial, educational, electronic record. I don't know if you've got an electronic health record. I've got one. Gosh, it saves my life. If I've got back pain, I don't know whether I need a physical therapist or neurosurgery. My primary care physician sends me over to a radiologist. They do an MRI, sends me to try physical therapy. That doesn't work. We go on to surgery. We do whatever we do. I don't have to tell my story every time. All of those systems are connected. My records follow me, with my consent, of course, but they follow me. And that way, each physician, each specialist can know, oh, 7 years ago you had this condition, maybe it's related, right? They can integrate it. That's what we're trying to do in the psychosocial educational space, is create a cumulative electronic record beginning prenatally but following that infant all across time, right? So we're working with software companies to develop that concept and to bring it to communities. Finally, we're also working on putting it all together into population impact. The Get Ready Guilford Initiative in Guilford County, Greensboro, North Carolina, through funding from Blue Meridian Partners, a capital aggregation group, and the Duke Endowment, with evaluation from MDRC, we're developing the idea of putting it all together, prenatal to kindergarten, to see if we can put these pieces together, get all these community resources, and have a major population impact on the kindergarten readiness, health, and well-being of the population of children entering kindergarten in that community. They have 6,000 births a year. All right, that's very exciting. I'm going to close with this last slide, which addresses Ron's concern about financing. How do we pay for it? On the one hand, it's Family Connects at Birth is relatively inexpensive, about $600 a family community-wide. Some families take up a lot more than that in dollars and some less than that, but that's the community-wide average. We are now engaged with the state of Oregon, the governor and several state senators and community leaders there, to bring Family Connects to all 24 or 45,000 births that occur in the entire state of Oregon a year. To bring Family Connects will cost about $24 million a year. That's either an astoundingly large figure or a minute drop in the bucket figure, depending on your perspective, but it's about $24 million a year. How do we finance it for that entire state? Well, we're beginning to develop this idea of a state, federal, private partnership as a way to pay for it and a way to sustain it. So in Oregon, we are exploring the idea that maybe about $8 million of it could be paid by the Medicaid contract between Oregon and the federal government could be revised to incorporate Medicaid payments for those families. Then state of Oregon tax dollars will come up with another $8 million. The final $8 million, to be determined but to be appealed, it could perhaps be paid by private health insurance. This may be a mandated part of your coverage of health insurance. So if you have Kaiser or Blue Cross or whatever insurance company is in Oregon, and they're both there as well as a number of others, to get those companies voluntarily to include this as part of your coverage, right? We'll be trying that out over time. Every community we've been in the country has a different configuration of financing and funding, and it's one of the real questions. So we'll see over time. But that's why I'm excited to be here and excited about this work and anxious to talk with you more about it. Thank you.
Exhausted from up and down. So next, Deborah Darrell, who, as I said, is associated with the First 5LA program and has been for a long time. She's going to describe First 5LA for you and the intervention program that they focus on. I think it's a very important example, and I hope you'll pay careful attention to how she discusses what LA has tried to do to expand their program and to improve their program. The reason it's so important is because we have so many big cities, big counties in the United States, and they have to figure out the exact kind of stuff that Ken just talked about, except they're not a rural county in North Carolina. They're places that have 1 million or 4 million or 6 million people, and it's going to be a difficult task to figure out how to coordinate all those services and how to pay for them. Known as Welcome Baby, the LA County has been implementing its home visiting program since 2004 and has been evaluating it and expanding it over time. The program is offered to babies born in 14 hospitals across the county, employs a systematic assessment tool that identifies families in need of intensive ongoing care, and provides core services to all families through the child's ninth month. There have been several high-quality evaluations of the program, including an ongoing random assignment study. Positive effects have already been shown on several important outcomes through 36 months of age. Dr. Darrow is a senior research fellow at Chapin Hall at the University of Chicago. She's one of the nation's leading experts in child abuse prevention policy and home visiting research. Deb.
Great, thanks. Thank you, Ron. Thank you, Ken. It's been my pleasure to work with these two gentlemen over the last year or so on this special issue, and it indeed is touching on something that I think is very important. My role today is to talk to you about the work going on in LA County. When Ron started, he talked about the competing values and how we set child welfare policy between parental autonomy, child safety, and child development. And how we define that has largely explained the system that we currently have. We have a voluntary system of prevention and a mandatory system of child welfare intervention, with the idea that we don't do anything for you until parents first fail. I think universal strategies offer us the possibility to realign those values and really work in a way that can produce better outcomes for families and children. I want to recognize my colleagues from First Five LA, Christine Altmaier and Barbara Dobransky, who actually wrote the article that I'm going to be talking about. LA County is like a two-pronged system if you think about it. It is talking about developing a universal prenatal program, Welcome Baby, which I'll talk about, but also altering the relationships among multiple agencies to build what I've referred to as an intelligent system. What do I mean by intelligent system? A system that adapts, a system that's responsive, a system that doesn't assume it knows all the answers, but is very opportunistic and works in ways where the data takes them. It's a system that's patient and waits for those opportunities. It's the ultimate example of incremental planning. This did not happen overnight. It's something that took some time. And as anybody looks at these strategies, both what Cynthia talked about, what they're doing in Texas, what Ken outlined in Durham, North Carolina, this doesn't happen overnight. It is a process. It's in a process of bringing together both agency managers as well as the community itself. Let me start by talking a little bit about Welcome Baby. It is offered with what I say without qualification to all babies that are born in 14 hospitals across the county. It employs a systematic assessment tool to identify families in need. The tool covers many of the items. It's called the Bridges Screening Tool, but it's many of the items that Ken is assessing through the Matrix tool they use in Family Connects. And it provides universal perinatal support to all families, a set of core services through the child's ninth month. This is somewhat different. This isn't a one-visit program. This is actually a program that is distinct and offers all families delivering in these hospitals a set of services. And what does this program look like? Well, it's enrollment. They do enrollments prenatally. Right now, their prenatal enrollment is about 10% of their total sample, but they have a very interesting pilot study underway at one of the hospitals where they're doing direct referral to Welcome Baby at the time a woman accesses prenatal care. So that's a way to increase the opportunity, make it more normal, make it more acceptable. It lasts for 9 months, and from prenatal to the child's ninth month. The dosage is a maximum of 9 contacts, 3 during the prenatal period, 1 bedside, and 5 that are postnatal. The staffing is a mixed staffing plan. The nurse does at least one. The visit that occurs right after birth in the home is done by a nurse, but the rest of the contacts are often done by what they call a parent coach, someone from the community that's been identified, works closely with families, represents the culture of the program recipient, and is a way, again, introduces this as part of community life. The content ranges in a variety of things. They offer specific guidance around breastfeeding, home safety, strengthening the parent-child interactions, and promoting child development. In addition, they do a standardized assessment on the baby's on the mother to identify any other concerns they might have, as well as the baby's ongoing development using the ASQ. The parent coach then assists the family in improving breastfeeding, establishing a medical home, and accessing other community resources. They've done a series of evaluations, as Ron mentioned, beginning with an early implementation in 2014. They then did a pilot evaluation of the way this program was implemented in one hospital, California, their Metro LA. I should never try to remember something that I can't. One hospital, high-risk neighborhood, and they did the pilot evaluation of that. I'll talk about that in a minute. They did a psychometric study about their assessment tool to make sure that the Bridges was indeed accurately predicting families that needed additional services. They've done an implementation and outcome study by RAND that was just completed, and they're in the process, as Ron said, of doing a randomized control trial by AIR. What are some of the early findings from the evaluation? Well, the pilot study that I mentioned was done by the Urban Institute. It was piloted in Metro LA from 2010 to 2015. It was families that received Welcome Baby were compared to a group of families who, while enrolled in WIC, did not have the opportunity to access the services. At 12 months, mothers receiving the Welcome Baby services were more likely to have initiated breastfeeding and to have exclusively breastfed for at least 4 months. The standard measures they used, the home, looked at all of their three of their follow-up points at 12 months, 24, and 36, and they found that program participants maintained a more appropriate home environment that was supportive of their child's development and engaged in more learning activities with their child. The 36-month finding indicator program participated more responsive, encouraging, and effective parenting. And the standard assessments of the children indicated that they were developing stronger communication and problem-solving skills. The implementation study that was done looked primarily at the fidelity of the model, how well was it implemented now that it's across and scale at 14 hospitals. I will say a word about fidelity. Not every fidelity measure was fidelity point was fully achieved. There was some variability in delivery. But those programs that had the strongest fidelity scores also tended to do the best with the most challenged families. So there is something to be said by following the model, even though you do want to do variability when it's appropriate. They didn't have a formal comparison group, but they did look at the performance of the participants in the program as compared to benchmarks of the study, and we find that when they're available, the Welcome Baby families did demonstrate stronger parenting practices, again, breastfeeding rates and safe sleeping progress behaviors. So what are the replication lessons from this? I'm not saying that people would uniformly just copy Welcome Baby. That's not what it is. But there are some learning lessons embedded in what they've done, that if you're a community that is developing a program where there are certain conditions, I think the lessons of Welcome Baby may be particularly useful for you. Those conditions would, if you're looking at prenatal enrollment, they now have some experience with this and they're moving forward on it and their numbers are increasing. If you have to work with a network of hospitals, in Durham County, I think two hospitals deliver 80%+ of the births. That's just not the case in LA County. Even with 14 hospitals, they're touching maybe 20% of the births. So if you're in a community with lots of different delivery hospitals, Welcome Baby has a story to help you resolve that. The workforce realities, if you can't use nurses, nurses are great. People love nurses. Absolutely love nurses, but in some communities, that's just not a viable option. So you need to look for some mixed staffing plan. Welcome Baby offers examples of that. It offers also offers examples if you're really into a two-tiered program where it's not just a single visit, but you want to provide some basic core level of support for that perinatal period. Again, I think the Welcome Baby examples are interesting. It really is a flexible foundation, if you will, for communities to look at and begin to think about how they want to adjust their resources. So I want to talk now a little bit about the system component of LA. And there are some factors that I think facilitated system change in LA. First and foremost, First 5 LA focused its revenue base on children 0 to 5 on a policy and system agenda. First 5 LA is a public-private taxing district. It's tobacco dollars. That money has to be used for children 0 to 5. So if there's one policy takeaway from this, really great if your community has a taxing source for 0 to 5. Also, they worked with their Office of Child Protection that had focused at this time on developing a countywide plan to prevent child abuse in response to some tragic deaths in L.A. County through their child welfare-involved children. That's not unusual in this country. It is happening with alarming frequency. and calls for greater child welfare accountability. So you had the child welfare folks at the time the prevention folks were expanding. The child welfare folks were also saying, brother, we need to know how to do this better. We need to kind of get out of the rut that we're in. It is LA is also service rich. This is a community that has been blessed with not just the McVee dollars, but there was a lot there before McVee arrived. And finally, they have a strong governance structure. My favorite is they have five supervisors that run the entire county of LA. Four of them are women. I don't think that's an accident. And they were able to propose and to put in place an initiative in December of 2016 that said, you know what, guys, get it together. We want a home visiting system. We just don't want isolated programs. We really want to work together. We want First Five at the table. We want the LA County Perinatal and Early Childhood Consortium, which is a consortium of all their nonprofits that are providing home visitation services, the Office of Child Protection, the Children's Data Network that's run out of USC, and I'll say more about that in a minute. And then the specific county departments of health services, public social services, children and family services, which includes child welfare, and probation. So it was an all-hands-on-deck kind of approach, and that you have 1 year to actually write this plan and get it going. The planning parameters they had to use, I think, are also useful for communities to think about. They wanted them to use and adapt evidence-based models. County just didn't want any programs put in place. They wanted the very best programs that were available to be put in place and expanded. They wanted you to streamline referral pathways. They wanted to figure out how to get families who are interested in services to the services they need. How do you work that system? How do you take a community where the pathways to services are not one-dimensional? They're not even one-directional. They both go both ways, and they cut across a lot of public and private agencies. They asked them to identify and fill service gaps, particularly for those at highest risk. They wanted to increase access to voluntary services for those involved in child welfare. So if a family was reported, they're not required to take these programs. But, brother, they sure as heck wanted families to be encouraged to take early intervention and preventive services. And then they wanted to improve and align the data monitoring and outcome measurement system. So as they've been working for this year and the plan they came up, they found themselves with some leveraging opportunities. First, in terms of service coordination and integration, they are working very hard with Medicaid dollars, called Medi-Cal in California, to weave this into pre- and postnatal care. This should become standard practice at the time you have a baby. Just like you go in and you get your regular physical checkups and you do certain things when the doctor recommends them, they want this to be part of it, part of your basic service of care. They also, interestingly though, worked through a network of community networks of integration and service systems that had been set up prior in response to some child welfare work to develop regional hubs in various neighborhoods within LA County that does the coordination of services within their neighborhoods and communities. So it wasn't just relying on Welcome Baby to do this. This was going to be a system where each community was setting up and replicating that data integration, that service integration part of it. In terms of data and evaluation, they were part of the Pew Home Visiting Data for Performance Initiative. So the consortium had worked very hard at coming already up with a set of standard outcome measures, a standard set of descriptive factors, and other issues that families could use, that communities could use to hold their programs accountable in a consistent way. They also are blessed by the Children's Data Network that's run at USC, which is a treasure trove of administrative data. They've used this effectively already for looking at their child welfare population to decide what are the trajectories of families that come into that system and how might we intersect with them sooner in the process. And they're able to use that data system now to look at families that are enrolling in preventive services, who is and who isn't. And those that aren't, what do they look like in the administrative data systems moving forward? So it's health, it's child welfare, and the like. Workforce development issues, improving supervisory standards, making sure that people that were doing this work were well-trained and well-supervised to do it, and to develop some consistency in how referrals were made. So that when no matter where door the family came into the system, they were going to be treated in a fair and equitable manner. They've also been blessed with a lot of funding and sustainability issues. Interestingly, McVee sends California $21 million. Only $1 million of that goes to LA County. It is really a very, very small percent of the total effort for home visiting. I can't underscore that enough. I know McVee sounds like a lot of money, but when you dilute it down to individual communities, in truth, most of the work that's going on the ground is state-funded or locally funded. They're working with targeted case management to allow home visiting to bill Title 19. They have new money from the Department of Mental Health, $40 million, to expand 3 intensive home visitation programs in order to increase service access. They're working with the probation department so that probation workers are trained in a home visiting curriculum, most likely parents as teachers. So when they work with families that have been referred to probation services, they're not going to just work about what got them into prison. They're going to help with their parenting, if that's appropriate. And the Department of Social Services, now statewide, is investing $89.6 million in a mix of federal and general funds to provide up to 2 years of home visiting services for families that qualify for CalWORKs. The Department of Public Health is also investing another $34 million. In other words, there's been a lot of funding that has come down as a result of the collaboration and a result of increasing the issue and visibility of it. So the county, in terms of early gains, the county has a strong leadership body now moving this effort forward. They've expanded the funding, not only in terms of more resources, but they're looking at eligibility criteria. How can they open the portal so that more families will qualify for these services? And exploring innovations that will allow them to really drill down with those families most at risk. They're focusing on new training opportunities to make sure that home visitors can address those more serious issues that they face. And they're getting buy-in from their governor, who just kind of has embraced this idea of full tilt, and he wants to take some of these initial funding streams and make sure they continue. So what has this resulted in? Actually, a growth in services. If you see this, there's more Welcome Baby families being served. There's more Healthy Families America families being reached to. Parents as Teachers has increased. Nurse Family Partnership has increased. And in a combination of ways, this has really moved the bar forward so that families can get better services. Let me talk a little bit about barriers, though, to this universal concept. Cynthia alluded to some of them. I just want to reinforce some of them. First, I think there are structural barriers to advancing this work. Organizational silos continue to promote a pretty narrow system for the agencies and for the people that work for them. They're not thinking big picture. They're thinking small picture. Somehow that has to be overcome. The dominant policy frame that we focus on is really about fixing parents, not reforming systems. If those darn parents would just be better, everything would be fine. Missing the importance of the context in which parents raise their kids. And replication is difficult. It's what we learn. We know that one size doesn't fit all, but brother, we sure wish it did, because that would make our job so much easier. In addition to those structural barriers, I think there's attitudinal barriers to this approach. We believe that parents, not the collective, raise children. Still, the dominant thing is that parents should take care of their kids, as if any of us do it on our own. It is such a misstatement to think that people with means raise their children and people that don't for somehow just can't cut the mustard. And I don't think that's true. I think that there is this sense that we all rely on resources. It doesn't have to be government resources, but we all need to reach out. And then if we limit support to the highest risk, if we can just find the families that really, really need our help, all will be well. The problem is the more we try to find the families that really, really need our help, the more invisible they become. The more they dig deeper into their own silos, their own retreats, and we indeed are not making the connection we could make. This picture says it all in my mind. It's really what we're talking about, which is targeted universalism. It's not about giving everybody the same, because if you give everybody the same, oh my gosh, some people still aren't helped. So we really do this about giving people the level of service they need. We can see here that when people get what they need, that's what equity is about. That's what equity is about, not just giving everybody the same. Going forward, I think in order to dismantle or minimize the barriers I talked about, there are two things I think that need to occur. First, I think we do need to redefine this issue so that it cuts across problems. To the extent we put child safety as paramount over child development, and we think that only people that are at risk of harming their children need help, versus those parents that could use some help in nurturing and developing their families, then we've missed the boat. We take a proposition that's 20 to 80 in some cases, if you focus only on the most at risk, to something that could be 80%, 90% need help, as Ken's data clearly shows. If you offer assistance, most people will say, you know what, I have some concerns. And you normalize that process, that makes a price point at which I think most people can embrace the investments in universal services. They make sense. And then secondly, certainly the evidence base needs to grow. We've made progress, we're collecting data, all is well, and we're learning. And we're most importantly, we're using that learning to do better, not just in LA and not just with Family Connects, but in many of the communities in which I come across in my daily work, where people are saying there's got to be a better way to address the safety needs of kids than the system we have now. There's got to be a better way than requiring parents to fail before we will absolutely offer them assistance. And I think universal services offer important infrastructure in doing better with both families and systems. Indeed, it's possible that the more powerful impact of this message and this effort is not on what it will do for families, which will be amazing, but what it potentially can do for how we organize our social service system. And in generating public acceptance for the idea in which the structure, scope, and quality of local service delivery systems respond to all families, not just to some. If these models work well, and as intended, I think they'll create communities in which every parent asking for help, in which parents asking for help will be normalized, and parents receiving the help they require will be the expected outcome. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, so now we have a chance to question all three. I'm going to focus my questions first on Deborah Darrell and on Ken Dodge, and then ask Cynthia to join in as she feels so motivated. And then I'm going to turn to the audience and give you an opportunity to ask questions as well. So we'll get to that in 10 or 15 minutes. All right, so the first thing that I want to ask you about is impacts. I mean, we're doing this for impacts. We expect that we'll be able to have impacts on kids and their families, and the kids will do better. We'll be able, especially in the topic we're talking about here, to avoid abuse, neglect, or at least reduce its rate. Are we doing well enough? Do we need to focus more on that? Do we need programs that are changed in some way relative to the ones we're doing now? Cynthia mentioned, and I mentioned, that most of the studies show that we're having pretty modest impacts on the important outcomes. So there might be reason to keep looking for a way to have more impacts. What do you think?
Absolutely, we need to have higher impacts. This is just the first baby step in a long plan. What I like about the field of home visiting is that there is a commitment to evaluating and to reporting those impacts. I think that gets us at least halfway there, because we're going to at least try. But as Jack Schoenkopf and a number of others have shown and have told us repeatedly, and you've been a leader in telling us this, that the magnitude of our impacts are just not what they need to be. So we need to continue to innovate. We need to continue to evaluate. One of the worries that I have for my own program, as well as the whole field, is that if we have a positive impact that we report it, we declare victory and a community says, I want it just the same way you did it. And I say, okay, well, you're going to get that same modest impact then, and we're stuck. We need to continue to up the ante and up the criteria and continue to try to improve our impacts.
Deborah.
Yeah, no, I think impacts, program impacts are one kind of impact. But unless we're going to change the context, unless we're going to increase the total level of services that are available, we're going to open up eligibility criteria. We're going to do better training and education so that people will voluntarily seek out these services. I think program impacts might always remain somewhat modest, because programs are one thing that they're doing. Mm-hmm. And it's the collective impact of what we do in communities that can support families, and what in public health has always been what has happened. You build safer cars in addition to getting people to use seatbelts. That's the kind of dual approach I think will be needed to really maximize the impacts we have. We know that home visiting programs that are in service-rich communities that have good referrals for families do better than programs that are isolated with no other resources to offer families. So I think looking at both is where we're going to find our effects.
Cynthia, your program was in a big state. Remember, you said it was a big
it's
state?
Big.
Mm-hmm. And you would expect, as you actually described it, that there are some places that have lots of resources, like Austin, and the other places that don't have very much at all. So this, I would think, would be a big problem with you. What's the solution?
Well, I think, as both Ken and Deb just said, that we can't just fund a home visiting program in a community. We have to think about home visiting as part of this whole system of care for kids. And so if we're going to invest dollars into that community, they can't just be for the program models. They have to ask the communities to identify what their gaps are, what the services are that the families need. And then we need to find ways to bring more of those services. Or find ways to get those families to services elsewhere, you know, through telehealth and other things. It's very hard in some of our small communities to get the level of services that families are going to need. It's just, we can't replicate it. We have 254 counties. You know, there's no way that we're going to be able to get everything there. But we can't just fund a home visiting program and expect that that's going to work, because it's about connecting those families to the services.
Ken had a very interesting model in one of his slides. I hope it was you, otherwise I made a mistake. But it shows a financing mechanism, and it shows Medicaid and then state or local contribution, primarily local, and then
insurance.
Mm-hmm. So we normally think of insurance being you keep people healthy, and that's what insurance wants, and they may be willing to contribute to this if we can show that we actually keep people healthy. And the state is going to have to deal with these people, or more than many of them, no matter what. So they may want to have a Medicaid contribution. And it seems like there has been some success in selling the program at the local level and using local dollars. Is that a good model? Is that the way to try to build this? Is that the first approach we should take to communities to say, here are three sources that have worked elsewhere, and if you can work all three of these and knit them together, you can definitely expand your services, not just for impacts, but to have better programs as well. Ken, you should respond.
So an additional source as a jump start, but I don't think a long-term solution, is philanthropy. So philanthropy has jump-started in a number of communities to get the program rolling, to get communities interested, but that is not going to be the long term. In the long term, I think it is some combination of public-private dollars, and fitting those together is a challenge. Federal dollars, state dollars, local dollars, private health care insurance dollars. We're in a good time. As I said about Oregon, they're thinking creatively about it. I live in North Carolina now. We have a visionary Secretary for Health and Human Services, Mandy Cohen, coming from CMS, and she has brought Medicaid managed care to our state starting this year. What an opportunity now for the Medicaid providers, organizations, entities. They're talking with us about bringing family care, family connects to those Medicaid families as a way to reduce their costs, because they're, you know, they're going to be responsible for health, and they have a limited number of dollars.
Let me stop you there. Will you have the opportunity, just I want you to guess, that you will be able to show that your program will do that, that it will save dollars for the state?
That's a tough question. The easy answer is we'll save so many dollars that it'll be obvious.
Right.
Yeah. But that's the easy answer. That's a tough one. I think we have to seize upon creative opportunities for evaluation. So, for example, in North Carolina, there are six regions of the state and six Medicaid entities have been given contracts. Well, why not randomly assign some? Or if not randomly, you know, the best you can, some quasi-experiment possibilities with different regions.
Yeah.
I think we have to, with every community, go into it and assess what's in the community and say, what's our best chance of evaluation here?
Yep.
and then apply those.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're doing those tests in LA now to show that they can save the dollars. Another movement that I think really complements what we're doing is the whole idea of thinking about the fourth trimester for women after they have their baby and investing more in that postnatal period. That's another place where I think insurance companies are really looking at that because that's a high-cost issue, and whether it's maternal depression or whatever, not just for the mom but for the baby. Mm-hmm. So I think finding out who are our compatriots, who are our partners out there, that we can begin to reshape the way healthcare is provided, and especially around the pre- and postnatal period.
Yeah. I mean, we don't ask philanthropy to fund immunizations, right? We actually have just integrated that into our services. And until you called it a psychosocial primary care, until that's just really fully integrated, then we're going to be doing this piecemeal approach, which is going to be difficult. In Europe, most European countries, follow-up visits postnatally are just part of standard practice of medicine. They wouldn't think of it separate as any prenatal care. So that, you know, that's a lofty goal and not coming tomorrow. So these interim mechanisms are really important to understand, and you guys have been extremely creative. But that's where we have to get if this is going to be really universal.
And it's developing a universal primary care system for everybody. I mean, the work that was done with David Ohl's program in the UK showed that it wasn't that big of a deal when you do it in a program in a country that has good basic primary care. People get the services they need. They don't need a special home visiting program to do that. So, again, I mean, you have to think about altering systems, not just thinking that these programs can shoulder the entire cost going forward.
I want to say something else about evaluation. So what's important about this field is we're trying to have population impact. Mm-hmm. Historically, the evaluators, and I'm one of them and a fan of randomized trials, but historically sometimes the evaluation criteria obstruct the program itself, right? The constraints of a rigorous program evaluation require what? Signed informed consent before you're even randomized to intervention or control. Well, that alone is going to exclude a significant portion of the population, perhaps the most needy, perhaps the most important. It's going to impose a constraint. If you got lucky enough to get randomly assigned to the intervention, you might be happy, and there's a placebo effect. If you got in the control and you know you're in the control, you could be ticked off and it could lead. So there are problems with that. So we have to get creative, maintain our rigor, but get creative. What we did with Family Connects was separate the intervention from the evaluation. So for intervention, there was random assignment, but it was based on an independently observable characteristic. If you were born on an even-numbered birth date, you're randomly assigned to the intervention. If you're born on an odd-numbered birth date, you're in the control group. We did that. 6 months later, we had an independent team of researchers come along, unaffiliated with the intervention program. They did not know the design or who was in intervention or control. And they did a cross-sectional descriptive study of families and went to families and paid them handsomely to participate in an interview and then assessed outcomes, asked birth date, and they could know, without having contacted the intervention program, whether they were randomly assigned to the intervention or not, right? They don't know if they got the intervention, but we're doing intent to treat design anyway. So we have to get creative with our designs. Mm-hmm. If we're going to have ecologically valid population-level interventions, we also have to have evaluations that honor that.
Good, that's great. I was going to ask a question about evaluation. Now I don't have to. I do, however, want to ask about what I think is still a very, very big problem with this field. I asked Cynthia about it, and that is attrition. And we have plenty of evidence that many of the programs that we use, not just in-home visiting, but in many other social interventions, attrition is a major issue. What are we going to do about attrition?
You know, programs are addressing it. One thing to think about attrition, though, do people leave because they don't need the program anymore? In other words, they don't need 2 years. In 1 year, they figured it out. They've got to. That's counted as a dropout, when in truth, maybe they didn't drop out. Maybe they just finished the program. So one of you mentioned the idea of looking at models that could be done in a shorter period of time, and virtually every model is doing that right now. They're trying to figure out, are there certain families that need a lower dosage of service? So constantly referring not to people need to come in, do a program, and leave, but rather think about people come in, they have a need met, they may go out into the world again, but if you can get them to come back, then you've changed that behavior pattern. And so I'm a little less worried about the dropout, more so the outright refusals if people are not doing it. I think we need to take that with the utmost seriousness. But we need to have a much nuanced, more nuanced understanding about what it really means to leave a program early.
Yeah, I agree. One of the major reasons that families are leaving the home visiting programs in Texas is that they get a job or their children get into a Head Start program or some other program and they feel like that's sufficient. We do have a large number of folks who are just lost to follow-up. We don't know why they leave, and that is a concern. And what's interesting is that the home visitors in some of our smaller communities, you know, they know these families, right? And so they don't just see them at their home visit. They see them at Walmart. They see them at church. They know their relatives.
They recruited them at Walmart, right?
They recruited them at Walmart. Not anymore. And so when these families are gone, they're really gone, because we've heard of home visitors really, you know, I won't use the word stalking, but that's what they used, you know, like they're finding the families if they can keep them engaged. And so these are families that are mobile. They're moving to another community. They're moving you know, to another state. And, you know, we don't know for sure that they got all that they needed. But there are a large number of families that are dropping out of our program. For them, I think that they would be satisfied with what they have.
Mm-hmm. Okay, audience, we welcome your questions. Please keep the question as short as you can so we can get to as many questions as possible. Let's start right here with this gentleman on the inside of the row. Someone will be here in a minute. Play poker or something. We'll have a microphone here.
I think for the recording.
What happened?
I have to have a mic.
Yeah. Okay. I could just speak loudly.
Okay. Stand up and scream.
Okay. So you all acknowledge that the impacts were fairly modest. I haven't read the evaluations, but it seems like you're focused on short-run impacts.
That's right.
It seems like there would be long-term impacts in crime outcomes, health outcomes, education outcomes, and maybe earnings outcomes. Is there any intent to look at these in the long run?
I can tell you with Family Connects, we are following families from our randomized trials over time. I'm not sure what, I don't have results to report to you. I don't know what we'll get. It's an important question. On the other hand, it's, at least for Family Connects, it's one slice of life, pretty small level intervention. The idea that $600 a family could have an impact on third grade test scores or crime outcomes in adulthood seems on the face of it too easy, but it's one step. So we want to understand, you know, I can make a theoretical case about how sure we're going to set families on a different trajectory and skills are going to get skills and we're going to get better. I don't think that's likely.
I think it depends on the system of care that they have over the course of their childhood. But there are some studies, and Nurse Family Partnership has done evaluations with long-term follow-ups, and some of the biggest impacts that they discuss are some of these reductions. So,
although the downside to longitudinal studies is then you're studying a group of people that were born at a point in time that's very different than what was born today. They just came out with the third generation of effects of the Prairie Preschool Program.
Right.
These people were, the original families were born in 1961. Life is different, and so there's a yin and a yang to that kind of thing. But I know the administrative data systems and our ability to match families is getting better and better. And a system that they've got in Los Angeles that Emily Putnam Hornstein runs at USC is truly amazing about the data she's collected on a statewide basis.
And we have some cases of answering any question like this is, well, Raj Chetty showed. And Chetty has done a study of housing programs that did not show serious impacts in the short run, but did show much more serious impacts in the long run. So I think many disciplines are thinking the long, we do have to look at the long-term impacts because they could surprise you. and they could be even bigger than the short-term impacts. Mm-hmm. And we have a couple of examples like that. It's not common yet, but that does show that we do need to look at the long-term impacts as well. Next question. All the way in the back there. Wait, it's, Mike's coming. Tell us your name and ask your question.
Sure. My name is Taylor, and my question is, other than more funding, which is something that everyone wants, are there any things on a wish list that you might have of pieces of programs or community involvement that might make a large difference in home visiting?
Pieces of programs. I thought you were going to ask, do you want to change the programs? I mean, my thing about these universals, not just do it at a way of asking people what they need, but also asking people what they can give. How do they want to be connected to others in their community? I mean, use it as a way to build social capital, not simply to ask, how can we help you? But in other words, make people understand that it's really a collective interaction. And I think that might generate some support that we have yet to unearth that goes beyond money.
I would like for states to change the way that they think about incentivizing and funding the actual home visiting programs. Right now, the most common performance measures are how many families you served and whether you spent all the money that you got, instead of any sort of impact that you made or the connections that you had. And I think by changing that, you would, and if you could provide the technical assistance to the communities as well, you could have them connecting more with one another. You could have them not feel so worried about meeting their numbers all the time that they're taking in folks who may not benefit most from their programs. And you can start to help them break down these silos that Deb was mentioning so that they're really integrating better in the communities. And I don't know that that takes a lot more money. That just really takes folks having the freedom to think outside of their individual program and think about how they're part of a system.
So the wish list that I have is to find a community or state that is able to take all of the dollars that are spent, government dollars that are spent, say birth to five or prenatal to five, and to pool those resources and to spend them in more flexible ways. That's really the ultimate of identifying what an individual family needs and then providing the resources that that family needs, and to be more flexible in the way that those dollars are expended and to see what impact we have. That wouldn't necessarily require any extra dollars, although I would also say I'm an advocate that we need to have more dollars for young children.
Right here on the aisle.
Oh, sorry, I'm having a leg problem. I was a teacher with the Even Start program, if you're familiar with Even Start. It was designed to help parents who had not attained their GED or high school diploma attain their GED, and then also it taught family literacy and parenting skills. I'm wondering if there is capacity to build parent support networks so that they're like in group classes with their children and have opportunity to connect with the community, like my program where we gave them opportunities to participate in the arts and in facilitating family literacy.
You know, I think, again, as the model, we think about home visiting as being very good because it's that individualized service, one-on-one. But pretty soon, families will start asking about who they can interact with and how they can learn from others. So having a group component, parents as teachers already requires families to meet in groups as well as to do their home visits. Other models follow suit to that because there is something about building that sense of collective. And if other programs offer an opportunity for parents to come together, not just to talk about the problems they're having with their kids, but to learn something new with their mm-hmm. children or to celebrate the joys of their children, mm-hmm. that's all to the better.
Those are ways of getting fathers involved, too. Those events are things that the fathers like to attend quite a bit. Touch a truck is a big thing in Texas. I kid you not. There's just big dump trucks and tractors and stuff, and everyone gets to go and climb.
Rattlesnakes, too, right?
Mm-hmm. I'm serious. Okay. Touch a truck.
Yes, they're on the aisle.
Hi, good morning. Cody Kornack with National Head Start. I'm curious to to touch on something that I'm not sure has been discussed yet today around workforce and collaboration. I think when we talk about some social service programs, one of the common challenges, at least when it comes to collaboration between things like Head Start programs and local child welfare, are high rates of turnover at the service provider level. So I'm curious if any of you can talk to the quality or the challenges of collaboration across programs, particularly when you get down to that individual level. And secondly, whether or not you all have evaluated outcomes based off of the quality of that sort of frontline provider, things like their experience or otherwise.
So it's a terrific question about the workforce. Who, and I interpret that in two ways. But most importantly, who's going to provide these services, do these home visits, engage in these interventions? We've used nurses because we did focus groups, interviews, pilots, and at birth, everybody loves a nurse. Social workers, as wonderful as they are feared for taking your child away from the home. Child development specialists aren't as relevant as mom wants a nurse to make sure her baby's still alive and kicking and thriving. And so we get high participation rates. That presents a workforce problem. Can every community field the number of nurses that we may have? Great question. We may need better nurse training programs or different kinds of professional training programs. I like what I heard about L.A. County, where across the lifespan, you might think about a team, and maybe a nurse post-birth is really valuable to the family, but you might not need a nurse prenatally or at age two if you've got primary pediatric health care, you might need a child development specialist at that time. So we could figure out the workforce solutions in that way.
I will just say the workforce issue may be one of the biggest challenges. Then just speaking from the state of Illinois, I'm on the Illinois Home Visiting Task Force, and openings on our home visiting programs have really skyrocketed. This is a strong labor market. People can get jobs doing other things. They're leaving. And so what can we do to attract
parents,
and keep people?
Right.
The home visiting workers are turning over because it's not the highest paid job in the world. It's a demanding job. You can earn a living doing something else. And so programs are trying to come up with creative ways to nurture their staff, to give them a little extra training, to give them some sense of a trajectory that they could be putting them on so they can graduate into some other kind of employment. But I would say that going forward, when we don't meet our numbers in Illinois, with all due respect, that's what McPhee wants you to do, when our caseloads are low, it's because the program has lost a third of their workforce going forward. So it's a significant issue that I don't have a solution for, sad to say, at the moment.
The solution to that, as everything else, is money. Pay them more.
You could pay them more, but,
hard.
It's not just the money. It is a demanding job. It's you're on call. It's young babies. It's women that might present with a variety of tests. If you could find something a little more normal in your job career, you may opt for that. I would suspect, unless we can come up with some other interesting companion piece to this job, some sort of rotation, some sort of, when you talked about the group services, maybe you rotate into that to give yourself some emotional break from the work that you're doing. I just think we need to be thinking more creatively about how we staff the programs.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you all for coming. And I want to thank all the members of the panel for traveling all the way here. And
thank you, Ron.
Especially in this weather in the Midwest, you all may meet some difficulties. I want to recognize John Wallace, who's the editor of the Journal, has been for many years. He's an amazing editor. That's the kind of guy you never see, but boy, oh boy, do you see the results in the editorial work that's done on the Journal and in the policy briefs. So thanks again for coming. We'll look to see you the next time, which will be in about 6 months. Bye.
Thanks.